Today is June 20th, the day after June 19th, Juneteenth. Dates such as this are important to remember for their particularity, for their history, their specificity, their history, and for the voices that need to be heard. If we don't do this, so much is assumed or lost. But they also open doors for us to look at the whole of our reality. So we have to hold both, honor the specificity, and allow it to teach us to look more deeply and generally. So each of these 2 days, June 19th and June 20th, have a particular meaning, and each invite reflection and commitment. So I'm sure that all of you know that Juneteenth is the day we celebrate, we honor, we recognize the liberation of African American people from the institution of slavery. The Emancipation Proclamation, which freed enslaved people in the Confederate States, was announced on January 1st, 1863. 2 months after the end of the war, June 19th, 1865, this pronouncement was announced in Galveston, Texas. Juneteenth began as a celebration in Texas, in Galveston, the following year, and spread from there. There is a lot to this story, a lot to this. So please investigate it. But I think we can think of this date as a date that marks both a definite, concrete change in status. A definite, concrete change in status. But also as a promise, a possibility of true freedom and equality, and a promise that has yet to be fulfilled. That brings us to the importance of June 20th, at least in my mind. It is necessary to mark and celebrate the end of the formal institution of slavery in this country. We need to do that. But we know if we stop there, we do not take the next crucial step of making equality and justice a reality. We do not do the practice of June 20th. The pull of delusion is great. The pull of selfishness, ignorance, cluelessness, maintaining status. We can see that in our history and in our own lives. On June 20th, we take steps to make real the vision of Juneteenth. This is our practice. We see delusion as delusion. We act internally and in our daily lives to undo delusion, promote liberation, and transform our lives and our world. We start... We start with acknowledging, we say this every Friday, all my past and harmful karma, all our past and harmful karma, born from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. All my past and harmful karma, born from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. The institution of slavery arose from greed, a desire for more, a willingness to oppress others, enslave others to get it. The root of this greed is delusion, the delusion of separateness, the sense that happiness lies in gathering more and more and more and more, and that this more will protect us, will give us peace. This delusion can be so thick that it leads to ranking beings, enslaving beings, and hatred. These delusions are expressed in body, speech, and mind, and they take shape in the systems we create. They can be so tenacious that even after a moment of liberation, we can reconstruct the same delusions in different forms. Jim Crow laws, terror and intimidation, and less obvious but no less powerful internal and cultural manifestations of oppressive laws and regulations. A normalization of profound delusion. These delusions manifest themselves in many, many, many ways towards many beings, and Juneteenth asks us to see those too. How we rank and order beings, how we assign value, how we slip into unconscious selfishness, how we think we are the center of the universe and therefore are able to steal from others. And yet, Juneteenth also points to the fact that we are also of the nature to wake up, to yearn for true peace, for freedom and justice, freedom from delusion, and the ability to enact our lives in awakening. The energy of liberation and the pull of delusion. There is a deep, in our bones, knowledge that my peace and happiness can never be purchased, never come about through the oppression of another. That greed, hate, and delusion destroy the mind of peace. And we can learn to spot how we can be hijacked by our habitual mind. So we need to take care. We need to acknowledge the reality of Juneteenth in our lives, the ways in which we stake a claim for liberation, and celebrate that. Celebrate it. And we need to face squarely the reality of June 20th, the day in which we make concrete our commitment to what we have claimed for our world on Juneteenth. This, it's important to note, this is not a morose. It's not about guilt or enervating, endless circling around our limitations. It's a clear-eyed acknowledgement of the fullness of what and who we are. In a sense, every day is June 20th, and there is such vigor in acknowledging that. There is a sense of groundedness, of purpose, of energy, and meaning. We may not accomplish the goal, but we can have the satisfaction of knowing we are living it. That is the Bodhisattva way. One of the most important things to consider in our practice is who we think we are and how we know that. Can we ask, who am I? Someone must be asking that, so who is that? We can dig and dig and dig and come up with more and more answers to the question. Lots of answers, descriptions, stories, it's all fine. But that can just lead us in circles. It is really good to ask that question. Who am I? What am I? And it is important to understand that we often find out through unexpected ways. Answering the question is not central. What is central is how we live, which is, of course, who we are. A being that is prone to foolish, corrosive delusion, and fundamentally an expression of the whole reality, the whole of reality, moment by moment. We are shaped by causes and conditions of this life, imperfect, a mix of narratives, gifts, and talents, wounds and liberations, wounds and limitations, wounds and fragility. And at the same time, we are an expression of life itself. And so never other than the whole of reality, which includes it all. We exist with very real histories and specificities, seen and responded to in very real ways in our relationships with others, ourselves, and culture. To deny the reality of that is to live in a fantasy that does no one any good. And at the same time, we are boundless. We are never fixed. We are this world. So we live at this intersection, the Saha world, we call it. It's a tricky business, I think, this intersection. Don't you think? I think it's a tricky business. And so we take care of ourselves, of our minds, of our hearts. We take care of the world. Aware of the particularity of this one and our identity with the vastness that unfolds, includes, and sustains us. We make a concrete commitment to our path and practice. We investigate the ways which it takes shape. We sit down and we remember ourselves to all that we are. And then we get up and we forget. And then we sit down and we remember. And then we get up and we forget. We are always on a journey of remembering, moment after moment after moment. And in that remembering, we benefit all beings. I think this is the practice of June 20th. This practice can take shape in many ways in our lives. Social action is one way. Speaking in behalf and acting on the behalf of liberation of all is another. Creative expression, caring for others. All the different ways that we bring life to our lives is the practice of June 20th. Living in Sangha, recognizing community. This way of living needs to be sustained by a commitment to remembering that is personal and specific. Zazen, study, chanting, expressions of gratitude, like bowing, short chants before we eat, experiencing beauty and the grace of life. Each of these and many more are the ways in which we make manifest this commitment. One particular way that I thought I'd talk about today is the practice of having a home altar. This may seem small in comparison to all of the needs of this world, all of the ways in which we need to respond to this world. It may seem like an insignificant act to have a corner on a shelf somewhere where you place a Buddha, but I don't think it is. Having and caring for a home altar is a way to express our deepest intention, what matters to us, what helps us to remember who we are, what sustains us, helps us remember how we want to be guided in our lives. When we stand or sit in front of our home altar, we are touched by what it is. We are touched by what we place there, what we intend. There are many ways to have a home altar, and we can even have an altar at work. Often these are incognito altars, like a little rock on your desk, or a small picture of a mountain, or however you want to do that. Traditionally, a Soto Zen altar is considered to be Mount Sumeru, the mountain on which the Buddha resides. And a home altar is a small version of the main altar in the temple. So these are some of the elements that are included in a traditional home altar. An image of Shakyamuni Buddha. You can see his head's a little cut off in the image, but that Shakyamuni Buddha. And Shakyamuni Buddha is central and usually elevated. Can also be a scroll, a picture. And we have a scroll in the back that's a scroll of Shakyamuni Buddha, and then Dogen Zenji and Keizan Zenji are sitting here, the two founders of the Soto Zen school. You might have a scroll, a statue, whatever that image is, You can have memorial tablets, images of our ancestors or deceased loved ones placed on either side of the Buddha. This is a way of paying respect and offering gratitude to those that came before. Offerings are made in front of these. Incense is really lovely. We use lavender buds here usually because it's a nice way if you pick up the lavender buds and you crush them a little bit, it's the scent, not the smoke, that's the offering, the scent. So you crush some sage or lavender buds, it just gives a little bit of scent and then it disappears. So if you're sensitive to chemicals or smells, this is a lovely way to offer a scent to the Buddha. Flowers or greens, candle light, water or tea, and food. These are all offerings that you can make. Most people simply leave an incenser or some little bowl of something sweet smelling on the altar, flowers, and a candle. Always be careful of candles. Make sure you put them out. If you do offer food, it's meant to be eaten afterwards, so as not to waste anything. Same is true for water and tea, but you can also offer it to animals or plants. So if you live somewhere where you want to take the food out after it's been offered to the Buddha and offer it to the birds or the squirrels or water a plant, that's a good idea. The bowl of incense or lavender buds is placed in the middle with the flowers and the candle on either side, usually the flowers on the left and the candle on the right. On another shelf, in a drawer, or nearby, you could place a sutra book, a copy of a chant, a mala, I don't have mine on today, but beads if you use those, a bell, a little drum, a little makugyo. All of these can be on the altar. It's also common practice when you receive a gift to first place it on the altar. It's one way to think of this is that we want the gifts that come to us to support our deepest intention, what's most dear to us. All of this, though, I've just described to you, and we have a little bit on our website. You can find things about how to set up a traditional Soto Zen altar. But it's completely flexible. Okay, perhaps you have a statue of Kenon, the Bodhisattva of Compassion, or Jizo, or a lovely rock. It doesn't matter. The point is to make this real for yourselves, to make a place of support, encouragement, inspiration. You may have pictures of people or beings or places that inspire you to recall your intention. You may have a phrase that you want to put there. Anything that helps you keep your practice alive. And there's no need for this to be always solemn. Fun things also sustain our lives. Maybe you want to offer a Snickers bar to the Buddha. Or maybe you want to put something quite delightful on your altar. The altar in my study at home is an image of Prajnaparamita, the mother of wisdom and all the Buddhas, a little statue of Fudo, fierce one. It has a small notebook that was given to me by a Dharma student who died a number of years ago, and a small basket of malas that people have given me over the years, as well as a few other things. When my parents died, I found little prayer cards that my grandparents had used. They were what's called Unity. Not Unitarian, but Unity, and honored all religions. It's a lovely little prayer, a morning prayer, that I keep on my altar. It's good not to get it too cluttered, but depending on your temperament, you might want to put a lot on your altar. The point is the altar functions as a cornerstone in our day-to-day lives of practice. We sit in front of the Buddha, We stand in front of the Buddha. We do gassho, putting our palms together and expressing reverence and gratitude for the teachings that sustain us and the many people and beings who have carried the teachings for us, as well as our family, those we care for, especially those who have passed on, those that inspire us, the natural world. It brings peace of mind. We remember when we are in front of the altar that we are sustained and supported in our lives, that we are not alone. We dedicate ourselves to this life in this way. In all of our stumbling, failing, messy efforts, in the midst of our delusions, we bring ourselves, all of ourselves, to this place, to this time, this mind, all of it. Messy, beautiful, flawed, deluded, dedicated, all of it. This mind, this body, this heart, we're there, in front of this altar, this personal place for us. It functions as the center, a place where the power of the Buddhist teachings takes root and enhances our lives and our work in the world. One formal practice that you can do is to light a candle, sit in front of the altar, or stand, respectfully offer incense or sage or lavender buds. You can pick it up and offer it like this and put it down. You can ring a bell 3 times, bow in kasho and chant Namu Shakyamuni Buddha, or homage to Shakyamuni Buddha. Or you could do the refuges, Namu Ke Butsu, Namu Ke Ho, Namu Ke So. I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Dharma, I take refuge in Sangha. Sit for a while, do a chant if you'd like, and end in gassho. We can simply sit zazen. You can wave when you go by. Hi, Buddha. Quick gassho. I'm out the door, running late. You can say hello when you come home. Hi, Buddha. Glad to be home. Thank you for being there. You can just bow silently. Quietly make a dedication. Again, it's a personal altar. And the practice there is personal. And so we can be creative. In addition to zazen, we can take time at our altar to reflect on our daily lives and what we want to bring to life in this world. We can ask for guidance from the wisdom in the world and all who are in it. Please, all those wise ones, guide us, remind us, encourage us. It's a place where we can take our worries, our overwhelm, our sorrows, our frustrations, our rage, our pain, and place them in the care of all beings. Place them in the care of the awakened mind of Buddha, the compassionate heart of Kenon, the fierceness of Jizo and Fudo. Here at that place, we know we are not alone. That alone, as real as it might seem, is not the most real thing. We live in relationship. The altar can also be a place to recall the good in the world. Sitting in front of our altar, we can recall all that supports us, all we have received, all that we rely on, all that sustains us, inspires us. With this remembrance, we can carry on the practice of June 20th. So I encourage you to create a place like this. I encourage you to remember Juneteenth, to remember June 20th, to create a place like this in your home, to return to it regularly. In non-COVID time, Shinshu and I might come to your home to help you dedicate an altar, if you want. That would have to wait for a little while, I think, unless we do it virtually. The point is to support yourself, support your practice, support waking up, and sustaining our participation in the world, making our intentions real, and finding all the ways in which we can remember that. Thank you very much.